content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the January 20, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Does one emotion rule all our ethical judgments? When prehistoric predators abounded, the ability to perceive harm helped our ancestors survive. Some researchers wonder whether it fuels our greatest fights today. By Elizabeth Colbert. On November 28, 1924, Raymond A. Dart, a professor at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was getting ready to attend a friend's wedding when a pair of South African railways workers staggered up his driveway with two large crates. The crates contained fossils that had been found at a limestone quarry some 200 miles to the southwest in the town of Taung. Although the wedding was being held in his own home, and his wife begged him to leave the boxes alone, Dart tore off the stiff collar he was wearing and rushed to find some tools. When he levered off the lid of the second crate, he later recalled a thrill of excitement shot through him. At the top of the pile was a rock that appeared to be a cast of a skull's interior. Dart, who taught anatomy, guessed that the skull had belonged to a primate, but it seemed too big for a baboon or a chimpanzee. Further rummaging yielded a second chunk of rock that seemed to fit right in front of the first, like a face. Dart was pulled away from his investigations by the groom, but as soon as the wedding was over, he returned to the specimens. Using one of his wife's knitting needles, he chipped away at the second rock until he had exposed the creature's chin, jaws, and eye sockets. The teeth, which appeared to have belonged to a child, were decidedly human-looking. More significantly, the opening for the spinal cord was positioned in such a way that it seemed the creature must have walked upright. In a paper published in Nature, just a few months after the wedding, Dart announced that he had discovered an extinct race of apes. He called the creature Australopithecus africanus, and proposed that Africa must have been the place where our troglodytic forefathers evolved. In the 1920s, the prevailing theory, strongly influenced by racial prejudice, was that humans had evolved in either Europe or Asia. The pro-Europe crowd pointed to a set of remarkably human-like fossils that had been unearthed in 1912 in Piltdown, a town south of London. Dart's announcement rubbed the scientific establishment the wrong way. One of its British colleagues labeled it preposterous. In the next few decades, as more Australopithecus fossils were uncovered in Africa, and as the Piltdown man was revealed to be an elaborate fraud, Dart was vindicated. In the meantime, he had moved on. The limestone deposit that had yielded the Taung child, as the original Australopithecus became known, also contained the remains of all sorts of other creatures, including baboons, turtles, and hyraxes. In another limestone deposit in Makapansgat, northeast of Pretoria, Australopithecus fossils had been found among a great jumble of animal remains. From these and other bits of evidence, Dart concluded that Australopithecus had been a ferocious hunter who had wielded animal bones as clubs. Man's predecessors differed from living apes in being confirmed killers, he wrote. They were carnivorous creatures that seized living quarries by violence, battered them to death, tore apart their broken bodies, dismembered them limb from limb, slaking their ravenous thirst with the hot blood of victims. Dart's account of the predatory transition from ape to man was profoundly influential. This time around, though, his theory was wrong. The Taung child, scientists now believe, lived around 3 million years ago. It was killed by a bird of prey, as were the animals it was found with. The bones in Makapansgat were left behind by large carnivores, like hyenas and leopards, who were also happy to consume an Australopithecus or two, if given the opportunity. Instead of being dauntless predators, our ancestors, it seems, were more likely prey. They spent much of their time and their increasing brain power trying not to become dinner. What does all this have to do with life today when big cats are headed toward extinction and meat comes on styrofoam trays? According to Kurt Gray, the director of the Deepest Beliefs Lab at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the answer is everything. In Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground, published by Pantheon, Gray argues that the most pressing problems of contemporary society can be traced to the Tuang child. Gray writes that it is easy to think that we have transcended our animal nature because we wear performance fabrics and prompt artificial intelligence to help with our knowledge work. In fact, all our thoughts and feelings arise from a mind that evolved eons ago. Gray describes himself as a moral psychologist, in contrast to moral philosophers who search for abstract principles of right and wrong. Moral psychologists are interested in the empirical matter of people's perceptions. Professor Gray writes, "We put aside questions of how we should make moral judgments to examine how people do make more moral judgments." For the past couple of decades, moral psychology has been dominated by what's known as moral foundations theory, or MFT. According to MFT, people reach ethical decisions on the basis of mental structures, or modules, that evolution has wired into our brains. These modules, there are at least five of them, involve feelings like empathy for the vulnerable, resentment of cheaters, respect for authority, regard for sanctity, and anger at betrayal. The reason people often arrive at different judgments is that their modules have developed differently, either for individual or for cultural reasons. Liberals have come to rely almost exclusively on their fairness and empathy modules, allowing the others to atrophy. Conservatives, by contrast, tend to keep all their modules up and running. If you find this theory implausible, you're not alone. It has been criticized on a wide range of grounds, including that it is unsupported by neuroscience. Gray, for his part, wants to sweep aside moral foundations theory, plural, and replace it with moral foundation theory, singular. Our ethical judgments, he suggests, are governed not by a complex of modules, but by one overriding emotion. Untold generations of cowering have written fear into our genes, rendering us hypersensitive to threats of harm. If you want to know what someone sees as wrong, your best bet is to figure out what they see as harmful, Gray writes at one point. At another point, all people share a harm-based moral mind. At still another, harm is the master key of morality. If people all have the same ethical equipment, why are ethical questions so divisive? Gray's answer is that different people fear differently. Moral disagreements can still arise even if we all share a harm-based moral mind, because liberals and conservatives disagree about who is especially vulnerable to victimization, he writes. Consider abortion. There are at least two parties who could suffer from terminating, or not terminating, a pregnancy. According to Gray, progressives focus on the harm suffered by women lacking access to medical care, and therefore come out in favor of abortion rights. Conservatives focus on the harm suffered by fetuses, and therefore support abortion restrictions. Arguments over immigration are based on similar differences in what Gray calls assumptions of vulnerability. Progressives focus on the suffering of innocent children fleeing war, while conservatives highlight victims murdered by drug smugglers. And so on down the list of hot-button issues. Liberals emphasize how trans women are vulnerable victims, while conservatives emphasize how they could be threatening to other women. As long as there's a perception of harm, there's a potential for outrage, because fear and moral indignation are inextricably linked. Indeed, Gray argues, the safer we have become from physical danger, the more hazards we see lurking out there. Millions of years of being hunted have made us preoccupied with danger, he writes. But without saber-toothed cats to fear, we fret about elections, arguments in group texts, and decisions at PTA meetings. Two key figures in Outraged are a pair of college-age siblings known only by their first names, Mark and Julie. One summer, while vacationing together in France, the two decide that it would be fun to have sex with each other. Julie is already on the pill. Mark, to be extra careful, puts on a condom. The sex is indeed enjoyable, but the siblings agree that once is enough. They resolve to keep the experience a secret, and this brings them even closer together. Julie and Mark are characters dreamed up by Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist who was one of the original architects of moral foundations theory. Haidt concocted their dalliance as a test. Would people who read about their incestuous encounter label it morally wrong, even when it was made clear that neither sibling suffered as a result of it? And if they did condemn the coupling, how would they explain this? At the time that Haidt invented the siblings, he was teaching at the University of Virginia. He recruited students there to respond to Mark and Julie's story, along with a macabre tale featuring a vegetarian named Jennifer. One day, Jennifer, who is working in a pathology lab, is asked to incinerate a fresh cadaver. Dismayed to see so much perfectly good flesh going to waste, she cuts a chunk from the body before burning it, and then, once she gets home, she cooks the chunk and eats it. 4/5 of the students surveyed found Mark and Julie's conduct immoral, while in Jennifer's case, the proportion rose to 6 out of 7. As for how they had arrived at their judgments, the students could rarely offer a coherent account. I don't think it's accepted, one student said in response to the Mark and Julie episode. That's pretty much it. From this and similarly strong but inarticulate reactions, Haidt concluded that the students had arrived at their judgments impulsively. Moral reasoning was mostly just a post hoc search, he wrote. Haidt's cheerfully incestuous siblings pose a serious challenge to Gray. If people consistently deem certain actions to be wrong, even when those actions cause no injury, then it would seem that harm cannot be the master key. Gray responds to this challenge with experiments of his own. One involves participants who were instructed to shoot each other with toy guns. In another, participants were quizzed about scenarios of the Mark and Julie variety. Among the scenarios was the case of a man who made love to a grocery store chicken. Gray claims that his results confirm the primacy of harm. Haidt may have told the students that no one was hurt by Mark and Julie's tryst, but, Gray concludes, this assurance did not convince them. The same impulse that made them condemn the siblings' hookup made them certain that harm had been done. Perhaps shame would haunt the pair in the future, or their families would eventually find out and be devastated, or society at large would fall apart because everyone would start sleeping with their siblings. People's intuitive minds simply cannot believe that harmless wrongs are harmless, Gray writes. The more harmful something intuitively seems, the more immoral it seems. Outraged was written at a time of extreme political polarization, and it is coming out just days before the polarizer-in-chief, Donald J. Trump, is set to be inaugurated. The book's tantalizing promise, as its subtitle announces, is that it will help us find common ground. Gray tries to make good on this with a section on the do's and don'ts of bridging moral divides. He starts with the don'ts. A big one is, don't imagine that facts are convincing. Gray cites a study from 2021 in which researchers argued with strangers about gun control. Half the time, the researchers tried to bolster their case with facts. The rest of the time, they offered stories, one of which involved a relative who had been wounded by a stray bullet. The relative, though made up, was presented as real. The encounters were taped so that the conversations could later be analyzed. Strangers who were offered anecdotes were, it turned out, much more willing to engage with the researchers than those offered data were. The group that got stories also treated their interlocutors with more respect. Sharing personal experiences instead of facts improved cross-partisan perceptions by about 0.7 to 0.9 on a 7-point scale, Gray writes. Trotting out statistics to argue against trotting out statistics. This may not seem like a giant effect, but it's actually quite substantial. Gray's takeaway from this is that the best way to reach across a moral divide is with a narrative, preferably one that features suffering. Respect is easiest to build with harm-based storytelling. Gray presents this finding as a cause for optimism. The reverse case could easily be made. In outraged America, stories of victimhood are legion. Trump, in particular, loves to share harm-based tales. The less true, the better. A typical example is the fiction the president-elect recounted in September about the immigrant community in Springfield, Ohio. Trump said, "They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there." If more harm-based storytelling isn't the answer, what is? To the extent that the research presented in Outraged is persuasive, it suggests that there may not be one. The essential and most compelling claim of moral psychology is that people make ethical judgments on the basis of intuition rather than reason. We have, it could be argued, been surprisingly good at muddling through modern times with the impulses we inherited from our troglodytic forefathers. But there have been close calls, and some of these occurred before the advent of nuclear weapons, climate change, artificial intelligence, and truth social. The great question of our era, and it is a question, is whether the mismatch is finally catching up to us. And now, the weekend essay from the January 11th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker. What's a fact, anyway? Journalists put more stress on accuracy than ever before. The problem is, accuracy is a slippery idea. By Fergus McIntosh. Every tribe has its myths, and journalists are no exception. In America, one common story goes like this. Once, in the pre-lapsarian era before social media, or before smartphones, or the internet, there was a time when journalists were trusted. Back then, everybody read muscular daily newspapers and watched straight-down-the-line TV reporting. When citizens had to make political decisions, a robust social contract with the media ensured that they were well informed, even if they couldn't always agree on what to do or whom to vote for. They could rely on a shared set of facts. But then something changed. People stopped paying attention to the news or decided that they didn't believe it anymore. They got distracted by podcasts, Facebook, and Twitch. They became ill-informed and started to act against their best interest. The media decayed and fragmented along with the nation. Opinion and news became indistinguishable, misinformation ran amok, and that is how we came to live in the post-truth world. The story is not unsupported. Trust in many institutions has fallen over the years, but in journalism it has plummeted. In 1972, Gallup began asking people in the United States, how much trust and confidence do you have in the mass media? The numbers used to be highly favorable. In 1976, more than 70% said they had a lot, and very few reported having none. But in 2024, a plurality of respondents, 36%, said that they had none at all. A survey of how highly Americans rated the ethics of various professions found that only a fifth believed journalist standards were high or very high. a better ranking than car salespeople and senators, but worse than bankers and chiropractors. Almost half said that journalist standards were low or very low. Increasing numbers of Americans report not following the news, or doing so via factually unreliable social or alternative media. In some parts of the world, the picture looks rosier. The Nordic states, outliers as ever, have far higher levels of public trust in journalism. But one recent study of 28 countries showed the balance of media trust and distrust to be neutral at best and negative among the most developed nations. Meanwhile, large swaths of the industry have been on the retreat, racked by dwindling advertising revenue, hostile governments, and declining audiences. In the United States, the number of people employed in newsrooms dropped by more than a quarter between 2008 and 2020. Thousands were laid off in 2024 alone. In 2022-23, the Committee to Protect Journalists recorded more journalists jailed worldwide than ever before. Technological change, most recently and acutely the mainstreaming of generative artificial intelligence, presents its own challenges, as does political polarization. In the United States, for example, the erosion of trust in journalism has been sharper and more consistent among Republican voters. And it can seem, in both parties, that many people turn to the news more for affirmation than for information. What passes for truth often depends on where one falls on the political spectrum. It is no coincidence that Donald Trump's venture into social media has truth in its name. This is a grim picture. But buried in the statistics is another story, one in which people worry about misinformation, even if they can't agree on what to call it. Fake news is not a new concept, but many Americans now register displeasure with inaccurate or unverified information on social media, and a majority now think that somebody, perhaps even the federal government, should do something about it. There seems to be widespread recognition that bad facts are bad news. Globally, fears of an information war are rising, and despite endemic skepticism and distraction, there is an enduring thirst for reliable information. The question is, where can it be found, and how can its purveyors make themselves heard amid the noise? One answer has been to turn up the volume, to loudly pronounce that, in a fallen world, only we can provide accuracy. Networks such as NBC and the BBC have launched units dedicated to fact-checking what other people say, as opposed to checking their own work. And for the first presidential debate of 2024, the New York Times tasked 29 staffers with combing through the candidates' statements in real time. Not every entrant in the accuracy economy is as large or well-resourced. In the past decade, hundreds of small fact-checking websites have sprung up around the world, including many in countries such as India, where press freedom is far from a guarantee. Many of these sites received significant funding from Meta's third-party fact-checking program, the end of which the company announced earlier this week. Whether rooted in service or business strategy, this sort of political fact-checking, which spotlights the specific claims and seeks to confirm or disprove them, is hardly neutral. Setting out to counter inaccuracies, it often takes the form of rebuttal and necessarily entails editorial decisions about what to cover. No outfit can scrutinize every statement made by every politician, and none of them wants to. An insistent focus on pointing out misinformation may even inflate the scale of the problem, to the benefit of what the writer Joseph Bernstein has labeled big disinfo, and to the detriment of a publication's appeal to uncommitted readers. The sense that journalists are worth listening to has as much to do with how they go about their work and with the uses to which readers can put it as with what they actually say. The provision of facts does not, in itself, engender trust. What is more certain is that, from time to time, every journalist, no matter how well-meaning, gets something wrong or misses the point. This is true even if, as Michael Shudson, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, has argued, American journalism is deeper, more analytical, and more investigative today than it was 50 years ago. If there ever was a golden age of journalism, we may be living in it. The trouble is, pointing out the mistakes of others is not enough. If people are to trust journalists, we need to earn it. The New Yorker is known for its accuracy. At least, that's what the magazine tells itself. In reality, it depends on whom you ask. A prospectus announcing the first issue of The New Yorker in 1925 promised that, quote, as compared to the newspaper, The New Yorker will be interpretive rather than stenographic. It will print facts that it will have to go behind the scenes to get, but it will not deal in scandal for the sake of scandal, nor sensation for the sake of sensation. Its integrity will be above suspicion. True to this mandate, The New Yorker maintains an obsessive interest in facts, and it didn't take long for the early editors to recognize the usefulness of at least basic stenography. In 1927, the magazine published a profile of the poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, America's first starlet. Its first sentence, Edna Millay's father was a stevedore on the wharves at Rockland, Maine, sounded good, but like plenty more in the piece, it was not true. Millay's father was a school teacher turned insurance agent. The embarrassment inspired The New Yorker's founding editor, Harold Ross, to install a fact-checking department. And since then, checkers have left their marks all over the magazine. John McPhee, in an essay published in 2009, depicted fact-checking as a pursuit bordering on mania. To shore up one important but rickety anecdote of his concerning wartime nuclear reactors, a checker spent days placing calls that ricocheted all over the United States, from Brookhaven to Bethesda, from La Jolla to Los Alamos. The chase culminated, moments before the press deadline, in a call to a Florida police department, which the checker enlisted to track down a crucial witness who turned out to have gone to the mall. He called the checker from a phone booth, just in time to correct an error. Not many pieces require such heroics. The reality is that fact checkers are busy people who traffic only occasionally in the dark arts of deep research. Most facts can be checked fairly easily today, especially with the benefit of the internet. But since there are so many, a checker has to prioritize. Merriam-Webster defines a fact as, quote, a piece of information presented as having objective reality, end quote. A long piece might contain thousands. When a particular fact turns out to be sticky, persistence, and attention, rather than any kind of special knowledge, are generally what's needed. Checkers are not infallible, and their successes are mostly due to hard work and creativity. What is truly extraordinary about any fact-checking department is that it exists at all. At the time of writing, nearly 30 people work in checking at The New Yorker, almost all of them full-time. It is labor at scale that produces accuracy. But the pursuit of accuracy, that is, confirming a fact as a fact, is only part of the project. With a few pragmatic exceptions, fact checkers go over everything published by the magazine, editing for balance, fairness, and context. Writers are asked to share their sourcing. Checkers review both research materials, books, articles, emails, documents, and original reporting. For complex topics and as needed for corroboration, they do their own independent research, perhaps conferring with relevant experts. And, unless there's a good reason not to, they get in touch with every person and entity discussed in the story and comb through what's attributed to or said about them. This fulfills a few functions. If the person cooperates, as they typically do, The checker can verify factual details, including those which appear within quotations. If they disagree with something, they get a chance to comment or correct the record. And if they are angry, well, it's better to know before publication. This step is also important in libel proofing a piece. Under U.S. law, a good faith and thorough effort to discover the truth is a solid defense should you accidentally publish an actionable inaccuracy. No matter how solid your standards are, it does not look great if you didn't bother trying to contact the person involved. Checkers may discover hidden holes in a story or garner perspectives that ought to be included. Most important, perhaps, this process, which is a kind of re-reporting, gives a checker an opportunity to test the basis of each statement of fact and opinion. Is the writer relying on personal experience, the pages of a half-remembered book, a third-hand rumor, or years of study? The value of a source, whether a person or a document, comes down mostly to quality of information. Depending on the stakes, are we talking about what I ate for breakfast or the location at which I saw the crime occur? And on what other sources are available, a checker may then need to seek corroboration or to do some reporting of their own. Finally, based on all this, they can decide what should be said and how. After a fashion, they decide what the magazine believes to be true. Truth, in this sense, is sought and rendered, something produced by rigorous inquiry and informed consideration rather than something discovered. Many points, tweaked as necessary, can be stated as fact, but often a checker will want to insert a citation, according to, or present conflicting accounts. Tone matters and can be used to indicate the level of confidence. A fairly made assertion may be one that leaves room for doubt. Falsehoods that reveal something about the speaker may have enough value to keep, so long as they are rebutted, but detail that is truly unverifiable or clearly and unfixably specious will typically be cut. Deciding what not to publish can be just as important as deciding what to keep in. In the landscape of a story, fact-checkers' trails can often be followed along a path of hedges and denials, but an elegant fix may render the footwork behind it invisible. Dispiritingly, checking tends to be at its most visible when it goes wrong, as when, despite Der Spiegel's dozen-strong research department, a star reporter there turned out a few years ago to have fabricated many of his stories. Among other things, he pretended to have interviewed Colin Kaepernick's parents and described the administrator of Fergus Falls, a Minnesota town, as a lonely singleton who'd never been to the ocean. Residents responded with a photograph of the administrator and his girlfriend embracing on a beach. Because The New Yorker, like many publications, trades on its reputation for accuracy, readers can easily feel cheated, even betrayed, when an error slips in. The tendency of letter writers to complain about failures of The New Yorker's vaunted fact-checking department is surely a form of flattery. This is not simply a commercial problem. Trust, as the philosopher Annette Bayer once wrote, is a fragile plant, one that can easily be damaged by the kind of increased scrutiny or skepticism that a flaw, once noticed, tends to induce. After the roots have withered, they can be hard to restore. Trust is something that journalists ask for. It's also something that they give. Just as readers learn about the world from the news, so journalists learn from their sources. Another philosopher, Neil Levy, points out that much, perhaps most, of what we know on the basis of testimony, and, except in some unusual cases, we acquire knowledge through testimony only when we trust speakers. Most information comes to us from other people, whom we choose, deliberately or not, to believe. As journalists, how and why we make these choices is particularly important. In the same essay, Levy writes that Trust makes us vulnerable. And if this is the case for a writer, it's doubly so for the reader. No reporter can avoid that vulnerability, but mediating it is essential to earning and keeping the trust of a reader. Journalists choose whom to trust on their reader's behalf. For journalists, and for anyone, there are certain shortcuts to trustworthiness, including reputation, expertise, and transparency. The sharing of sources, for example, or the prompt correction of errors. Some of these shortcuts are more perilous than others. Various outfits, positioning themselves as neutral guides to the marketplace of ideas, now tout evaluations of news organizations' trustworthiness. But relying on these requires trusting in the quality and objectivity of the evaluation. Official data is often taken at face value. But numbers can conceal motives. Think of the dispute over how to count casualties in recent conflicts. Governments, meanwhile, may use their powers over information to suppress unfavorable narratives. Laws originally aimed at misinformation, many enacted during the COVID-19 pandemic, can hinder free expression. The specter of this phenomenon is fueling a growing backlash in America and elsewhere. Although some categories of information may come to be considered inherently trustworthy, these too are in flux. For decades, the technical difficulty of editing photographs and videos allowed them to be treated, by most people, as essentially incontrovertible. With the advent of AI-based editing software, footage and imagery have swiftly become much harder to credit. Similar tools are already used to spoof voices based on only seconds of recorded audio. For anyone, this might manifest in scams, your grandmother calls, but it's not grandma on the other end. But for a journalist, it also puts source calls into question. Technologies of deception tend to be accompanied by ones of detection or verification. A battery of companies, for example, already promise that they can spot AI-manipulated imagery. But they are often locked in an arms race, and they never achieve total accuracy. Though chatbots and AI-enabled search engines promise to help us with research, when a colleague interviewed ChatGPT, it told him, "I am to provide information that is as neutral and unbiased as possible." Their inability to provide sourcing and their tendency to hallucinate looks more like a shortcut to nowhere, at least for now. The resulting problems extend far beyond media. Election campaigns, in which subtle impressions can lead to big differences in voting behavior, feel increasingly vulnerable to deepfakes and other manipulations by inscrutable algorithms. Like everyone else, journalists have only just begun to grapple with the implications. In such circumstances, it becomes difficult to know what is true and consequently to make good decisions. Good journalism offers a way through, but only if readers are willing to follow. Trust and naivete can feel uncomfortably close. Gaining and holding that trust is hard. But failure, the end point of the story of generational decay of gold exchanged for dross, is not inevitable. Fact-checking of the sort practiced at The New Yorker is highly specific and resource-intensive, and it's only one potential solution. But any solution must acknowledge the messiness of truth, the requirements of attention, the way we squint to see more clearly. It must tell you to say what you mean and know that you mean it. Next, from the Art World section of the January 13, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, "Every mandala tells a secret. If the Buddhist art is meant to guide us to enlightenment, it just as often reveals the blood, beauty, and mystery of earthly life," by Jackson Arne. There was more flaying than I expected, though not necessarily more than I wanted, at mandalas mapping the Buddhist art of Tibet. Any visitors going to the Met's exhibition in search of tranquility will find a 15th century flaying knife, a pair of flayed cadavers embroidered onto a rug, and another flayed cadaver with colorful guts stretched like caution tape around a palace. They may find tranquility, too, just not the cuddly sort that American pop Buddhism advertises. For the Himalayan monks of the early teen centuries, the ideal setting for initiation was a charnel ground, where people left their dead to be eaten by wild animals. If religion can't help us amid the stink of rotting flesh, what good is it? A millennium ago, India was still a Buddhist headwater. Various schools flowed north and east to China and Japan, but one, Vajrayana Buddhism, left its richest deposits on the Tibetan plateau. It's a nice irony of this show that remoteness can speed up transmission. The Himalayas were uncrossable for a quarter of the year, but travelers needed to get through all the same. And many of them spent months near the southern side of the mountains, waiting out the snow and soaking up Buddhist culture. By the 13th century, Vajrayana was close to extinct in its own birthplace, and Tibet, the ex-satellite, had become the new center. Ideologically, too, remoteness worked to the school's advantage. Its leaders stressed tantric chanting, ritualized sex, and other secretive practices. But as Christian Lukzanitz suggests in an eloquent catalog essay, they could be flashy about those secrets. Some of the most ravishing works here were painted in distemper on cloth so that they could be rolled up, transported anywhere, unfurled, and re-hidden the second they started to dazzle. Tibetan Buddhism persuaded with sheer pictorial beauty. Not only with beauty, of course. Impatient rulers liked that Vajrayana promised enlightenment in one lifetime, as opposed to the usual Buddhist dozens, and Kublai Khan spread its teachings as far as his horsemen could ride. But even here, pictures drove the religion's expansion and begat other pictures. Kings commissioned mandalas to clinch future success. After they won the battle or survived the plague, they celebrated by demanding more opulent versions. You can find two Timur, Kublai Khan's great-great-grandson, in the bottom left corner of a 14th century silk mandala he requested. Baby Khan is nowhere near the most important of the many beings depicted here, but it's an honor just to be included. Centers and satellites are still the idea. Above him float several squares within circles, and as the geometric shapes get smaller and more central, the figures within get more important. Not mortals, but minor deities. Not minor deities, but the big guy, Vajrabhairava. Know him by his blue skin and buffalo head. Sound complex? It is. But one thing this mandala definitely isn't is bulky. The shapes seem to slide soundlessly against one another. The in-between spaces are loosened up with gorgeous floral squirms of green thread. Even when I squint at the little reproduction in the catalog, I get a sense of complexity that has been captured without being tamed. Too big to belong to any single person, least of all the one who paid for it. If I were smarter or stupider, I would try to use the rest of this review to settle the question of what Tibetan mandalas, not the only artworks here, but the most striking, were used for. I can take some comfort in the fact that not even the Met's experts agree on an exact answer. At a recent conference hosted by the museum, an eminent professor claimed that they could be understood primarily as meditation aids. In the catalog, another insists that there is no basis for this interpretation. There is plenty of basis for the interpretation that mandalas are symbols of the divine cosmos, designed to teach initiates about the real thing. Unless mandalas are vessels in which the divine resides, nothing symbolic about them. They are teachers and icons, maps, and billboards, propaganda for the Buddhists who create them, and also for the kings who fund them. The most famous ones don't even exist, since they are studiously destroyed as soon as the monks finish making them from sand. Mandala gazing calls for a buffet of prepositions, an at that is also an in that is also a down upon. You're meant to start along the edges and proceed clockwise, passing the pictures of monks, deities, or patrons in their neat squares. From there, go inward to a circular plate on which a four-gated palace rests. Generally, each gate is guarded with a pair of prongs that suggest a vajra, a Buddhist scepter. Making it past these, and you've broken into the home of the main deity, who sits at the center, circled by lesser deities, while waving a weapon, or, depending on the version, embracing a consort. You can imagine each layer stacked on top of the previous one. Three-dimensional mandala models are arranged this way, so that the further in you move, the higher the image pokes out of the picture plane. Inward becomes upward. Either way, you are doing with your eyes what Buddhism says you can do with your life, proceeding from outer to inner, base to noble, ignorant to enlightened. The crawl from one to the other matters as much as the enlightenment itself. Skipping the charnel grounds isn't an option. Observe no fewer than 8 of them at the outskirts of a single 11th century Nepalese mandala. Greenish jackals feast while birds nibble on skulls. And why shouldn't they? They are part of the cosmos too. The red surrounding this mandala's central deity is a Buddhist symbol of purity, but also a reminder that purity starts with the flesh and blood that everybody gets for free. Even if you know nothing about Buddhism, even if you're in no mood to learn, this show would be worth visiting for the eerie loveliness of the color. One mandala depicting the goddess Jnanadakini has barely a crack to show for almost 700 years of existing. The colors are all pomp and hot splendor. Red grabs hold of softer pinks and jades and apricots and makes them burn. Slower to strike, but no less sensational, are the abstract patterns of frantic, curling lines you find throughout, as though Himalayan artists of the late 14th century had somehow visualized brain coral. When line and color work together at full tilt, as they do behind the walls of Jnanadakini's palace, the patterns get so dense that they could almost be solid fills. Peace is made to feel like a state of faint, cheerful vibration. Biography of a Thought, a huge mandala painting that the contemporary Nepalese artist Tenzing Rigdal contributed to the show's atrium, is pat by comparison. Blue is just blue. Solid is just solid. And taking this all in after marveling at the real thing is like washing fine wine down with syrup. Distemper does not survive 7 centuries unless someone is guarding it from breath and sunlight. One point on which all the Metz experts agree is that mandalas weren't made for mass gawking. Most Vajrayana initiates journeyed through them with an experienced master as a guide. That was probably a shrewd move on the master's part. Images, the good ones at least, are always richer than their official meanings, which is why so many religions police or ban them. In a distemper on cotton mandala from 1800 or so, the deity Ekajata resides in a palace guarded by corpses and surrounded by smoky darkness. There's an obvious progression here, from smoke to body and body to divinity. But maybe it leads from divinity all the way back to smoke, which gets brighter and livelier the longer we stare. Thick clouds seem to push out beyond the rectangle they're in and beyond any bounds anyone might try to place around them. Religious art could have been doing so much more with smoke this whole time, I thought as I looked. Fire and water have hogged the spotlight for too long. smoke has its own glamour, its own deathless wriggle. In this mandala, whether the monks approved or not, it gets the starring role it was born to play. Next, from the January 14, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, The New Combustible Age. The Los Angeles fires hark to the 19th century blazes that ravaged our cities and point toward an even more flammable future, by Daniel Immerwahr. Chicago, where I live, is a city of striking architectural uniformity. Rows of sturdy 2- and 3-story flats stand at attention on countless streets. Their fronts come in different colors and have idiosyncratic decorative flourishes. But approach from behind, via the alleys, and you'll see that they're usually made of the same stuff, Chicago common bricks. From that vantage, whole monochromatic blocks can look as if they've been designed by a single deranged architect, compulsively making the same unassuming building over and over. There is a reason for this. In October 1871, the Great Chicago Fire, as it became known, killed hundreds and consumed more than 17,000 buildings, many of them made of wood. Going by current estimates, the Los Angeles fires have destroyed more than 12,000 buildings. In 1874, another conflagration scorched Chicago's downtown, turning 47 acres to ash. The city's stylistic unity comes, in part, from the fact that so many of its homes were constructed in the period after the fires. Those bricks, required by Chicago's post-fire building codes, shout, "Never again." Although Chicago's Great Fire was particularly horrifying, many U.S. cities have a lingering civic memory of the time when it all burned down. San Francisco has a phoenix on its flag. So do Atlanta, Lawrence, Kansas, Portland, Maine. Detroit's flag features a distraught woman standing in front of a city ablaze, along with the paired mottos, Speramus Meliora, we hope for better things, and Resurgit Ceteris, it shall rise from the ashes. Such was life in a wooden country. North America's immense forests made for cheap timber, and the young United States was consequently racked by repeated conflagrations. A year after Chicago's 1871 fire came one in Boston. Then, 8 months later, Portland, Oregon. The year 1889 alone saw devastating blazes that each burned hundreds of structures in Bakersfield, Seattle, and Spokane. The Los Angeles fires are a nightmarish glimpse of a more combustible age. They are hard to process because it had until recently seemed that the age of infernos was over. By the 20th century, new technologies, light bulbs, radiators, gas heat, meant that fires didn't start as often. Safer materials and stricter zoning meant they didn't spread as far. More hydrants and beefed up fire departments meant that they didn't last as long. New York City's worst 19th century fire in 1835 destroyed some 600 buildings. Its most notorious 20th century fire, at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in 1911, took more than 100 lives, but was limited to 3 stories of a 10-story building. The structure still stands, now part of NYU's campus. Fire has been humanity's constant companion. Our bodies evolved around it, and no recorded society has lacked it. Yet the 20th century did much to remove fire from view. A historically astonishing, though often unremarked, feature of modernity is how relatively flameproof it has been. Our ancestors once lit large pyres and worshipped fire gods. Today, it is perfectly possible to go months without seeing flames rise higher than they do on a stovetop burner. The Angelenos, who are now watching whole neighborhoods, their neighborhoods, burned down, may have never before seen a single building aflame. Modernity's victory wasn't so much in extinguishing fire, however, as containing it. More than 3/4 of energy consumed today comes from burning oil, coal, or natural gas. This happens not in the open, but in boilers and combustion chambers. Like a misbehaving child, fire has been sent to its room. Out of sight, it has been going about its work of wresting carbon atoms free and streaming them skyward. Those concealed flames, we now understand, are more dangerous than the spectacular infernos that once incinerated 19th century cities. Global warming has desiccated California, which was never known for its copious water supply. When you add to this decades of misguided fire control tactics that sought to suppress all fires rather than let combustible biomass regularly burn down, you have conditions where the slightest touch can kindle a megafire. In 2018, during a dry spell, a rancher in Mendocino County used a claw hammer to drive a concrete stake into the ground. The sparks hit dry grass and set off a blaze that, in combination with another, burned more than 600 square miles across four counties and lasted 161 days. That 2018 fire burned largely uninhabited land. The most fire-prone homes in California lie in the ex-urban fringe that geographers call the wildland-urban interface. This has long been a dangerous place to build, and scenic Malibu has been particularly vulnerable. In the 1990s, the historian Mike Davis, fed up with the hand-wringing over protecting luxury enclaves, laid out the case for letting Malibu burn. But we're now facing wildfires so furious that they march past the city's edge onto its grid toward downtown. Los Angeles, which has had only 0.02 inches of rain since September, is now experiencing the worst fires any U.S. city has seen in more than 100 years. The 20th century's quenching of fire now looks less like a historic victory than a temporary respite. We tried to bottle fire up, but it is spilling out. After the 1870s, Chicagoans rebuilt their city in safer materials. Los Angeles won't be able to protect itself so easily. When fires grow large enough, as California's drought-powered megafires have, everything becomes fuel. Better housing stock can mitigate dangers, but the underlying problem, global warming, is systemic. Fireproofing California will take more than a brick. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.